This is Andrea Chase, and I'm talking with Ed Solomon about his film Levity, an introspective examination of sin and redemption. The film stars Billy Bob Thornton, Morgan Freeman, Holly Hunter, and Kirsten Dunst. Solomon wrote the screenplays for Men in Black and co-wrote Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And my first question is, how do you get from Men in Black and Bill and Ted to something that's very theological in a non-denominational way?
I think all of us as human beings have so many different parts of ourselves that we find interesting or that we find unexplored or that confuse us, questions that we have. And I love comedy. I love great comedy. I love writing comedy and I love watching it. But not every story that comes out of me or I think out of anybody is shoehorned into a certain genre or another. And this is a story that had been with me for a long, long time because I had initially met these kids that had committed these kinds of violent acts when they were teenagers. I'd met them back all the way back when I was in college and I was tutoring at a youth prison. And the first ideas for the movie kind of came then. And in my mid-20s, I did try to write it in my mid-20s, but really didn't have the depth or the chops to write it. I put it aside after about 30 pages. And about 10 years later, I finally was able to start it and really complete it. And I actually thought that because I had finished Men in Black, that I would have a better shot at setting this movie up. And one of the reasons I wrote Men in Black was because I was thinking that that might be a commercial film that could open the door for me to direct something like this. Ironically, it didn't really, because the doors that it opened either were filled with people who really wanted me to do more Men in Black-like things, or if someone didn't care for Men in Black, it really didn't open that door. So it didn't really have an effect on my ability to get this film made, strangely.
And yet you did. And it's a testament that Men in Black 2 was basically a retread of Men in Black 1, so obviously they liked the script.
Well, they made the sequel, even though I was going to make a joke, with the joke being that all my profit statements for Men in Black show that it's actually still in the red. So I was going to say they made the sequel anyway. It proves that they're in it for the art, really, not for the money.
Yes. Well, some of the most creative science fiction being written today are the profit and loss statements of major studios, wouldn't you say?
That's right.
Gone with the Wind, we keep hoping it'll turn a profit.
I wouldn't be surprised, by the way, if they say that with Gone with the Wind.
Billy Bob Thornton plays an ex-con named Manuel Jordan, who's suffering from guilt of a murder he committed over 20 years ago. And he's so guilt-ridden that he's essentially passive. And the way you describe him is he's between two worlds. And I get a very strong sense that he's in some sort of limbo or purgatory, just to keep the theological metaphor going.
He called me, Billy called me, in one of the rare conversations that we actually had about the character, because once Billy becomes a character, he is the character. And he called me and said, I have a thought about the way Manuel lives in the world. And I had my own very distinct thoughts about it, and I was, of course, very interested in what he had to say. And he said, I think Manuel's a ghost. I think he haunts the world. I think he is so detached that he rarely sits down, that he rarely takes off his coat, that he doesn't take off his gloves, that he sleeps on top of his covers under his coat. He won't relax into the world. And I thought that was perfect. And because I think this guy, by his own hand, which is why I called him Manuel, removed himself from the flow of humanity and still is alive, and then is left to kind of think and ruminate about his consequences. And because he has a conscience, he has to deal with it, and he has to somehow ameliorate his conscience and come and reconcile with himself what he did. So you can choose one way or another, I guess, to deal with that. I mean, if you don't have a conscience or you don't feel anything, you can choose to forget about it or put it aside, and you can be a sociopath. That's one way to go. And another way to go is, well, let's say you feel deeply and you want to make up for it. Again, if you can either be a spiritual individual, let's say, who has faith, or you could be someone who has no faith. To me, it was much more interesting to take a character who had no faith, because if you have faith, it seems like the answers are a little more, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's prescribed. There's a path for you laid out, and you sort of march through certain steps, and you can choose, I guess, whether you feel you've become, let's say, redeemed or not. But if you don't believe in God, and you say you don't believe in God, and you can create a very, or I should say, you can present a very rational explanation for why redemption's not possible for you, I thought that was a more interesting place to start. Like, well, then where do you go? You know, do you behave well? And what does well mean? And how many acts of, quote, goodness do you have to perform in order to make up for one act of true horror? And I'm not sure that's an even answerable question, but it's, the thing that's driving Manuel is his intention to try to rectify things within himself. All of this happens, of course, after the beginning of the film, where he's essentially told, it's time for you to get out of jail, and he says, I don't want to go.
I was going to ask why his name was spelled with an A instead of an E.
Because of the implications, yeah. Just by hand.
But also, Manuel Jordan, it has biblical overtones. Almost Emmanuel.
You know, you're right, and it's funny. I did some time with a bunch of kids that had returned from jail sentences for very violent crimes, and a couple of the kids, strangely enough, were named Manuel or Emmanuel. It was funny. So the name just felt right to me. There were two of them. One was Manuel and one was Emmanuel. I didn't name it that because of the religious connotation, although I liked the name Jordan because of the river. I liked the idea of a river. And at one point in my mind, a river was much more of a character in the film. There was a river moving through the town. He was constantly going out to a river. There's a scene in the film now where he's standing over a bridge looking down at people below, and he's throwing snowballs off. And then for a little moment, he's joined by the person that he killed, and they have a little conversation. And initially that took place over a river. And then the river dissolved. In the film, it was going to dissolve into the flow of people moving across. And the idea, the image of this man sort of detached from the flow was what I was thinking about. I lost the river for a couple reasons. The first was it just practically didn't work for us at our very, very low budget to find a city that had a river that we could shoot in at the way we needed to shoot. But on another level, it just seemed to fall away as a kind of vestigial image. Just didn't quite apply to the film anymore. I think a lot of first-time directors make the mistake of trying to will their vision, quote-unquote, onto the screen no matter what, because that's the way they saw it. And what they lose sight of is that the film, if you allow it, can really grow and start to surprise you and tell you, in fact, what it's becoming. And I think the real challenge, especially for a first-time director, is where do I lean on my initial instincts and where do I allow this thing to emerge in a way that's different than I anticipated? And then how do I continue to make creative choices that augment this growing film? It's a very complicated process, in particular because you're always shooting completely out of order. So it's tricky.
This is your directorial debut. Was directing everything you'd hoped it would be?
Directing was everything I'd hoped it would be in some ways. It was nothing like I'd expected in many ways. The feeling of invigoration was certainly there. The ability to be the arbiter of taste was there. The power that comes with running a set was there. The sense of control, like I'm finally controlling something I wrote, eluded me in the same way that a horizon sort of eludes you as you chase it, you know. And I realized that that's a delusion. The idea that as a director you control your film, you have more control, of course, than as a writer. And more decisions come through you. Most of the decisions, probably all of them, come through you. In our case, all of them, because we didn't have a studio behind us making the film. One of the benefits of not having a lot of money is that you don't have a lot of people looking over your shoulder, or at least in our case. Some low-budget films also have a lot of people looking over your shoulder. We didn't have any. So I got on too many tracks at one time there. so I didn't. The idea that you actually control your movie is a bit of a delusion, because you, in fact, are trying to facilitate all of these different complex individuals who are really talented in many fields, and you've got the weather, and you've got your locations that you've basically been given or that you've chosen. In our case, since we didn't have a lot of money, we couldn't really build sets to suit us, so we had to find things that worked for us, build a little other things. We couldn't afford a lot of extras, you know, to populate the city, which was actually okay. Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, and I chose to make the city look more stark anyway. We wanted it to be a more of a metaphoric landscape, more subjective landscape, since Manuel's character emerges from this state of isolation into the real world, and because his emergence is a gradual one, and the boundaries with Manuel aren't so clean in that he's kind of living in the past and the present at the same time, and he's sort of living in the real world, and maybe has a relationship with the boy that he killed that's sort of real, and, you know, he's got a imaginative life that's happening while the real life. There's a lot of fuzzy boundaries in his world. We wanted the world of the film to mirror that, to be this gradually emerging subjective experience, which interestingly makes the film more of a Rorschach for people, because sometimes people see the film and project one thing, and sometimes they project others, and people will, I've heard people argue, really argue vehemently for, you know, a point about this film that I didn't even, never saw, never suspected. And then people take the opposite side and argue, and it's sort of interesting. I think, by the way, part of it is I really wanted to use silence in the film. And, I mean, it's not like it's that long. It's, you know, it's 9.5 hours. just kidding. it's 95 minutes long,
there
you know.
There is an intermission on
it. Yeah, there's an intermission, and people can you know, go... you know, there's a little nap. There's like little Japanese subway station beds that you can sleep in.
Oh, those little shelves, yeah.
Yeah, those shelves. Yeah. It's really, I think, a very humane film-going experience. It's, no, we really want, I wanted there to be silence. I mean, not, hopefully not too heavy, but that there is silence, and that, you know, when that happens, you either, you fill it in, and as a viewer, and you either fill it in ways that are intriguing to you, or you know, interesting, and that's what I was hoping. Or it can repel you. You can just go, what the heck is going on? You know, wait, what? You know, and you can get mad, and, I mean, it's fascinating to watch. It's surprising to me.
One of the reasons I thought of Limbo, or maybe even Purgatory, when I was watching this film, is because of the winter scenes, of course. It's very dark, and it's very sparsely populated, like you mentioned, and also the color palette you chose. Talk a little about how important that snow was, as far as creating the mood.
Initially, I thought the film would take place in a summery, very populated city, and it was first a matter of practicality. We were told probably we're going to have to go to Canada, and then we were told we have to go to Montreal, and we have to go in January, which wasn't very far away.
Yeah.
And this was, we were told this in October and November, so it was very close to shooting. So I called Roger Deakins, the DP, and I said, listen, there's a thought here about shooting the film in the snow. I have a vague feeling that this is a better idea, but everything that I've wanted to do in terms of Billy Bob's character moving through crowds, and that all changes. And he said, well, let's talk about it. And we opened up the script and went, wow, this is better. It's way better. It takes all of the ideas that were initially in the forefront and puts them in relief. So I developed that initially out of practicality, but then I cannot see the movie any other way. That's what I mean by lack of control, mm-hmm. in a way. Things are handed to you. I mean, you have the control to say either yes or no and accept the consequences, I guess. No would have meant not making the film. Or you try to make it work and evolve the piece. So that was one of the ideas behind the snow. The other was with the production designers, very, very talented man named Francois Seguin. We chose a color palette that never used primary colors except in the farmer's market scene with Holly. We wanted a kind of desaturated and purples and desaturated greens and blues, and all the hues and tones of the film are sort of within that modality. Marie-Sylvie DeVoe, the costume designer, as well, sort of worked within that. Everybody had a similar take on the sort of visual design of the film, which was really good. And Roger lit the film because we didn't have a lot of money, and we knew that. We made a choice early on to design a lighting style that complemented the themes of the film while also being affordable, because we couldn't overlight the movie. We just couldn't carry those lights around, and we didn't have time to set them up, to be honest. So Roger suggested a sort of isolated pools of light with slightly richer color tones in the lights than he might normally use. But what we did was essentially light the film so that it's almost entirely lit with practicals, meaning the lights that you see. There's support behind them, but not much. And it was an incredible act of artisanship and of artistry on Roger's part, because then what you end up with is these pools of light and these characters kind of emerging in and out of them, which thematically, to me, was really appropriate.
The nice thing about a small budget is it can make you so much more creative.
I absolutely agree. In fact, rules in writing are not problems. The rules, they're rules. I mean, some rules can hurt you if they get in the way of the flow of something organic and natural, but certainly comedy works better with the more rules of decorum, the more things you know you can and can't do. You can use it all to your benefit if you are willing to really try. Absolutely true.
Manuel makes references to a 10th century book.
Ah, yes.
They give him the five rules of redemption.
It's unsure whether it was written in the end of the 10th century or the beginning of the 11th century, but it was...
They didn't keep time the way we do in those days.
No.
It wasn't as important.
You know what happened? The batteries on their Palm Pilots would constantly go out.
Yeah, and it was so hard to find the recharging stations.
You couldn't get them. They were like, you had to mail away, and they hadn't invented a postal service. The book that I was referring to was Maimonides, who was a Talmudic writer, who wrote about the five stages of redemption. And the reason I thought about him was, as I said earlier, I was trying to think, okay, what if you have a guy who doesn't believe in God, who committed an act that, you know, has spiritual overtones, whether you believe in God or not? I mean, if you don't believe in God, it's just a violent human act. And if you do believe in God, well, then it's got its own spiritual implications. And what if on some levels he wants to be redeemed? How would he go about it? You know, what would he do? And I was talking to a very good friend of mine, a rabbi named Naomi Levy. And Naomi said, Maimonides wrote about redemption, and he wrote about the five stages, and so she sort of showed it to me. It worked kind of nicely for me as a paradigm, and the five stages are basically, the first stage is acknowledging what you've done. The second stage, as Maimonides writes, is showing and feeling true remorse. The third is to make it right with your neighbor, and the example he uses is, if you steal somebody's chicken, you know, you go and bring him another. The fourth stage, then, is making it right with God, which you can't do until you do stage three. And then only when you've completed stage four can you go to stage five, which is being in the same situation and doing something differently. And Manuel basically sets out at the very beginning of the film to defeat all five steps. And so, not to defeat them, but I say disprove that he's capable of them. He can't bring this boy back like he's a stolen chicken. He doesn't believe in some God that's going to open his arms to him, even if he does. And as for step five, time, make sure you're never in the same place twice. So for him, he knows there's no chance. And then he sets out on this path, which is somewhat schematic in that I did try to structure the film around a chance for him to potentially or potentially not be in the same kind of place, which creates a kind of external structure to the film that is the only real external structure there is that. The rest is a different kind of internal structuring that was much more complicated than that. But again, I personally don't feel that redemption is something that I even know enough about to say whether he's achieved it. It's funny because when you talk about a theology, I mean, there are certain, for instance, Christian theology, I would assume, suggests or states that you have to accept Christ, I think, to be redeemed. Well, Manuel doesn't accept Christ. He doesn't accept God. He doesn't believe in God. So certainly there's no direct Christian theological underpinnings. I think redemption is an issue itself, as many, many, many faiths and even secular ideologies deal with redemption because it's a big issue. Anyway, he goes upon this path, and I don't know whether he actually does get redeemed or not. I don't think a human being can really offer redemption. I think a human being can offer forgiveness. You know, you can choose to forgive someone for something or forgive yourself.
The title of the film is Levity, and in the film you explore a lot of different meanings of that word, which I just love.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I like its resonance for how it applies to what's not there in many ways.
Yeah.
Levity, like as in lightness, levity as in laughter or light, and the opposite of gravity. Manuel's done a real grave act. He's carried the weight of this on his shoulders, this burden, He so badly wants to release it. That's really what he wants. More than redemption, more than forgiveness, he wants to get this boulder off his back. And the only way he thinks he knows how to do it is to seek out the only living relative of the person he killed and try to become part of her life and try to help her. But in so doing, the closer he gets to her, the less he can tell her who he is, which is the central kind of dramatic question in the movie. But ultimately, what he really wants is some lightness. And the idea of laughter, to me, it's probably a subtler thing in the film than I realized, because I wanted it to be there constantly, which is that off-screen, people are laughing. In rooms just beyond his reach, people are engaged, arguing, laughing, crying. But all of that is off-camera. All of that is behind him, above him, to the side of him. But that he is not a part of that world. That's why at the beginning of the film, Manuel says, "What I remember most from before was people's voices kind of floating on the wind and laughing, like everyone was in on something, like it all mattered somehow." He's saying, you know, people are laughing because they're all in on the joke and he's not.
I have a semi-serious question for you. You're filming in the dead of winter in Canada. It can't be good for people. It can't be good for equipment.
It's not good for anything, really. It was really hard. And these guys, the cast, who would throw off the huge heavy blanket and then act, and then while their face was freezing back, you know, 20 below zero, it was very cold. Which, on a textural level, it may, you know, you see everybody's breath through the whole film, which I kind of like. Usually they try to hide that. Usually, a little trick for people who don't know this, usually what they do is when it's cold and people's breath is showing, they put ice cubes in the person's mouth, which cools off the mouth, which makes the air, it doesn't turn to steam as it comes out of the mouth. But we didn't do that. We liked that through.
No cases of frostbite, I hope. No one lost a nose or a...
No, actually, thankfully. But it means you must move a lot slower. You don't move as quickly. Everyone's wearing these big moon suits. So what it made us do from a filmmaking standpoint was choose what we shot much more carefully because we couldn't shoot as much.
Yes. Once again, creativity is spurred on.
By necessity, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, this is such an international film because you're American, it was filmed in Canada, your executive producer, one of them is Fred Skepsy, who's Australian.
Some of our money came from France, which I know, I was just going to make a Freedom Prize joke, but I won't. Some of our money came from France, some of our money, our cinematographer was English, our production designer and costume designer were French and Canadian. Yeah, you're right. It's a real conglomeration of countries.
It's been like that in Europe for a long time. Anytime you see a European film, it's always money from all over the place, but it's moving in over here. Do you have to dance a lot more for that, or do you have someone who just manages that side of it for you?
Sadly, you do have to dance a lot for it. The studio system in the late 70s, as soon as they realized that you can have a blockbuster movie. You know, it took them about 10 or 15 years, but by the mid-80s, basically the studio system wasn't making really interesting little films anymore. They were making them as the exception rather than the rule, and instead were really going for films that could be marketed and cross-marketed and work in ancillary markets. And then as companies got more and more vertical, the idea of having films as kind of product or launching boards for other entities, televisions, cartoon, toys, things, all that cross-marketing became the key issue as to whether or not a film was made. So gradually the studios stopped making interesting kind of ambiguous odd films and started making only those. And because thankfully people still are hungry for films that are more pieces of people's expression and not so much part of a corporate business plan, there's still a market for that. And that market started to emerge in the 90s. And there was a lot of independent financing for films. And then independent films in the 90s were sort of like studio films were in the 70s in that way. And then enough people wanted to go see them that studios tried to get in on that. So they all opened up their, quote, classics division. This film's Sony Classics. There's Fox Searchlight. There's Paramount Classics. There was Miramax, which is owned by Disney. You know, all of these people branched into the independent world and just kind of subsumed them, I guess. And so now there's that sort of mainstreamy and independent kind of thing. However, funding for films, because it's so risky and because there's actually not so many independent theaters anymore, sadly. So releasing independent films is more difficult. So people need to share the risk, I guess, more. So you cobble it together any way you can. And we did some foreign money from the French, Studio Canal, some equity investment, people who just invested money in, and then bank loans supported by initially Columbia TriStar Home Video, which then became, once we finished the film, Sony Classics picked it up, thankfully, for us.
It's just amazing anything gets done. And remember the myth, the multiplex, there would be like Men in Black and then next to it, Levity. And it's not.
No, now it would be Men in Black and then next to it, Men in Black and then next to it, Men in Black. In other words, they put the same movie on four screens. It's just what we Americans like to do.
Yeah, yeah. I'm bitter. I'm bitter.
I don't see it as being good, but sadly, it's a kind of, because audiences don't entirely know the difference. In other words, they don't know what kind of films are really possible. You know, they don't really know, and they just become inured to it. They don't have any idea. It's just, we are, I think as a culture, why American films traveled the world so well is, you know, when our film industry was first forming, we were a culture of immigrants, and our films were primarily silent. But the people who were going to the films spoke so many different languages that the films were developed in a way that I think they really did appeal to many cultures at once. Whereas films like European films, films from countries with deep, deep, deep pockets of culture, you know, centuries and centuries of history, their films were more specific to their own cultures and countries. So European films don't travel to America as well. Asian films, Indian films, Middle Eastern films, they only play to the smallest percentage of American audiences that can see them. Whereas American films, they hit a lower denominator, and they developed and emerged as entertainment for people from many cultures. And I think it's unfortunate because, you know, my child, if I give him a choice between drinking, let's say, milk and, let's say, Pepsi, he'll drink Pepsi, you know, because it tastes better. It's easier, you know. And, you know, we're just sort of filling the pipeline with that right now.
Mm-hmm. It's irritating. I have another semi-serious question for you. You filmed this in the middle of winter in Montreal. Will you be filming in the tropics next?
I said to Morgan Freeman when I was in Montreal the day before he flew, I said, So Morgan, gosh, I hope you like the cold. And he goes, well, as long as it's 82 degrees, I don't mind the cold.
It's mind over matter.
Yeah.
Ed Solomon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.